Red Lamp District, Episode 12, Saved in Hope by Pope Benedict XVI, Part 5. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Red Lamp District. This is John, and I'm joined by Chris.
Hey, hey.
What's up?
What's going on?
Not too much. Not too much. We've missed a few weeks, but we got to wrap up Space Alvey here.
Yeah, man.
Time to put a bow on it, as they say.
Yeah.
Wrap it up, put a bow on it. We left off last time with, let me ask. So, anything you want to throw out there before we just dive in, or you just want to dive in?
I want to dive in, man.
Just want to dive. I really want to knock this thing out today. Maybe we just need to dive in. We got other things we want to move on and talk about in the next few weeks. So,
Sounds good.
Mama said knock this out, basically. So.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What year was that?
89 or something like that.
89. Yeah. Good year.
Uh-huh. All right. So the name of this section is Learning and Practicing Hope. It's been preceded by, first of all, the concept of faith-based hope in the New Testament in the early church. Then it talked about eternal life. And then we talked about whether Christian hope is individualistic or not. And the transformation of Christian faith, hope, in the modern age. And the true shape of Christian hope. So those have been kind of the big topics of discussion leading up to this in the last several episodes. And now we're going to hit on learning and practicing hope. So how do we put this hope into practice? How do we become better at being hopeful in the right way?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the gist of it.
Yeah. By the way, John, it smells great in here today.
Awesome. Well, that's probably because of my autumnal candle there.
Autumnal. Love it.
I'm all about the fall. The fall is one of my favorite seasons.
Is it?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I wonder what that says about your psyche.
It says what it says. I'm not a big fan. I like all the seasons, basically, except, it's not like I'm like miserable during the summer, but I'm just not like, I'm not a big fan. And especially we live in the Southeast where it's not only hot, but humid in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm more of a fan of the cooler weather.
Yeah.
And, maybe if I lived somewhere far north where like winters were just like, minus below zero Fahrenheit all the time and like snow everywhere and ice. Then I might not like winter as much, but fall is just nothing beats fall in my book.
It's good.
It's my kind of weather.
I love the candle.
Thanks, man.
Good fall smells.
Yeah. I appreciate your appreciation.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for appreciating my appreciation.
Oh,
I do appreciate that.
Well, we're just full of appreciation this morning.
Full love.
Plenty of appreciation to go around, people. Hey, you need to be appreciated? Just send an email over to the Red Lamp District. We'll appreciate you.
Yeah, we will.
That's right.
We'll really appreciate that.
That's us. That's cool. Send money, too. We'll really appreciate that. Learning and practicing hope. That's the theme of today. We left off, the last word was his love, meaning God's love, is at the same time our guarantee of the existence of what we only vaguely sense, and which nevertheless, in our deepest self, we await. A life that is truly life. Let us now, in the final section, develop this idea in more detail as we focus our attention on some of the settings in which we can learn and practice about hope and its exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So just to give us an overview of this final section, Pope Emeritus Benedict basically breaks down there's three main ways that he calls out as ways of learning and practicing hope. The first is prayer, which probably seems pretty obvious, but he has some good things to say about that.
Yep.
The second is action and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third is judgment, which might sound surprising to some.
Yeah,
that judgment is a way of learning hope. Judgment generally has negative connotations for most people. So we're going to explore why he says that that's actually a setting for learning and practicing hope.
That's good.
Yeah. So he has good stuff to say. All right. So we kick it off. And he says in section 32, a first essential setting for learning hope is prayer. When no one listens to me anymore, God still listens to me. When I can no longer talk to anyone or call upon anyone, I can always talk to God. When there is no longer anyone to help me deal with a need or expectation that goes beyond the human capacity for hope, he can help me. So great summary statement there. I mean, this is basically what it comes down to. This is what Christian hope is, that we're never abandoned by God, right? Like the world, everything else may abandon us, but we are never abandoned by God.
Yep.
So anytime, you know, we can always speak to him. And this is not some kind of like, well, you know, this is not some kind of wishful thinking for the Christian. This is when God listens to us. And arguably, like, there's so much scripture, especially in the New Testament, in the light of Christ, where it talks about the surprising notion that God is maybe most attentive to us in our darkest time, right? Like that we are most powerful in our weakness, right? That I've been thinking a lot about Christ's words on the cross, where he cites Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me, right? And those sound like such desperate words, but I mean, they really do. They sound like words of despair. But when you actually look back at the psalm that they reference from the Old Testament, it's actually the psalm ends on a rather triumphal note.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, as Christians, as those who follow the Christian hope, we can make reference to that even in our darkest time, right? Mm-hmm. When we feel forsaken, right? When we feel forsaken by others, and even when we feel forsaken by God, we can know that we feel like Christ did there on the cross.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's been there before.
Absolutely.
Wherever we're at, he's been there in terms of the sense of despair or alienation or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. So he also, in number 33, he talks about that we were created for greatness, for God himself.
Mm-hmm.
Man was created to be filled by God, but his heart is too small for the greatness to which it is destined. It must be stretched. I think what he's getting at here is the problem of why do we have to suffer, right? Why do we have to go through difficulty in this life, right? Oftentimes great difficulty in this life.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically references St. Augustine to say prayer is an exercise of desire, and that through prayer our souls are stretched, our souls grow. When I teach my 8th grade confirmation kids about prayer.
Yeah.
And because I'm really like one of my goals for, you know, is taking them into confirmation is like, you need to have a prayer life, right? Receiving this sacrament is not going to do you any good if you don't have a prayer life.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to talk to them about why that is. And, you know, this is one of the things I'll talk about the natural level of like, well, you know, when you're work, like, why do we have to work out in order to get stronger, right? Why do we have to go through this painful thing? And we talk about what happens on a microscopic level to your muscles, right? Like, you know, it's like little, there's like all this, like little microscopic tears and everything that happen in the fibers of the muscle.
Yeah.
And
feel the burn.
And you kind of make room for your body later to go back in and repair those and those tears. And what happens is they actually end up getting a little bigger.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and on a microscopic level, all those little tears fill in with more muscle, and you've actually made room for more muscle,
mm-hmm.
so that you're actually stronger and you get all swole.
Yeah,
right.
Got to feel the burn.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The burn is fat crying.
when I went to the Naval Academy, I think my plebe year, kind of the boot camp year, the whole thing was pain is weakness leaving the body. That was what they would always say. Pain is weakness leaving the body, right? I'm like, whatever, this sucks.
I don't feel that way.
I don't care what you're saying to me right now. This sucks.
Yeah.
But it's true in a way.
Mm-hmm.
When we pray properly, we undergo a process of inner purification, which opens us up to God and thus to our fellow man as well. In prayer, we must learn what we can truly ask of God, what is worthy of God. We must learn that we cannot pray against others. We must learn that we cannot ask for the superficial and comfortable things that we desire at this moment, that meager, misplaced hope that leads us away from God. We must learn to purify our desires and our hopes. So prayer is purification as well.
Mm-hmm.
We learn that oftentimes we ask for too little. Now, you know, sometimes people don't ask for too little and they don't hear you know, the answers that they want from their prayers.
Right.
Right. Maybe it's for a healing of a loved one who has a terminal illness and, you know, that prayer isn't answered.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Christian answer, you know, to that is that, well, God has a larger intention for that. Right. Mm-hmm. That, yep. you know, and there's this sense within Christianity that nothing is ever lost. Mm-hmm. Right.
And nothing's outside of the divine guidance and providence. And
right.
Even he works all things to the good. Even the most, even the darkest.
Exactly. That, and when we feel, you know, again, we can reference those words of feeling forsaken, right? Like that, Christ's own words of feeling forsaken. If that prayer, if Christ saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is, it can be read in a way as, you know, a cry of like, you know, why haven't you answered this prayer? Right. Then, what's the outcome of that, right? What's the outcome? Well, yeah, Christ dies, right? But what happens after he dies? He rises again, right? And he's glorified.
Yeah.
So we can see there that you know, the crucifixion is this great icon of you know, prayer being a way that our hopes are enlarged, that our desires are enlarged, and that we can grow to trust God to give us even better things than what we ask for.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I can testify to in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't always get the things you pray for, but,
yeah,
but you can look back many times and be like, but I got something even better out of it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This could be a silly analogy, but imagine like a kid, his parents want to give him a really big present. Mm-hmm. The big present is, I don't know, a basketball hoop in the backyard. And they want to surprise him. So they close the shades, and he's not allowed to go in the backyard. And he really wants to go in the backyard. He desires that. And he wants to go play on the swing set. Like, no, you know, you can't go in the backyard until later.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that's a painful experience for the kid. But the reason for that is that the gift is bigger. And the point of the, you know, not having what he wanted immediately was the bigger gift.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's a great illustration. Sometimes it's the illustrations that concern, you know, the kind of childlike desires, because, you know, children aren't coy about what they want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, a perfect example. 34, he says, prayer should be guided by the church. And I really appreciate this. You know, he talks about this Cardinal Nguyen Van Thuan. In his book of spiritual exercises, tells us that during his life, there were long periods when he was unable to pray and that he would hold fast to the text of the church's prayer, the Our Father, the Hail Mary, and the prayers of the liturgy. Yeah, I mean, I will say that I did not have much of a prayer life as a Christian for most of my life, you know, most of my life before becoming Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
It was something I felt bad about, but it was learning liturgical prayers and set prayers and feeling freer to pray those.
Yeah.
That my prayer life became more powerful. And honestly, like, I pray spontaneously a lot more now than I did before too. Right.
Yeah.
In a spontaneous fashion. But it's so helpful to be able, you know, when you just come across an issue, like, I mean, I tell you, my favorite prayer on a regular basis is probably just the sign of the cross. Mm-hmm. Right. Sometimes you don't even have enough time to spare a Hail Mary and in whatever circumstance, and making the sign of the cross is a prayer that you can offer up for whatever intention that comes across you.
Yeah. Well, you know what I love about the church's prayer, so the office, the daily office, like is that, you know, I can't pray all those times of the day like the monks do or whatever.
Right.
But I can sort of tap into that, you know, as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, the structure of it, sort of it, your day's not ordering you, your prayer's ordering the day. It's like establishing these sort of firm places in the day where you have firm footing.
Right.
Kind of return to home base or whatever. But what I love about the praying the Psalms and the liturgical prayers of the church is that, those words, you know, they're there, and you have to, like, talk about the idea of stretching the soul. You know, your desires and your wishes, like we talked about before with C.S. Lewis, our desires and wishes are too small.
Mm-hmm.
And those prayers teach us how to properly desire, how to hope, how to long for the right things, the things that God cares about, you know, justice for the poor, et cetera. So it teaches us, gives us the words to pray that we would not be able to articulate. It gives us not only the words, but the desires, longings, hopes, dreams that are God's own. So that sort of aligns us with Him.
Yeah, I can definitely testify to the, you know, to the power of the divine office, right? The liturgy of the hours. In the last several years, I've taken up praying it more and more on a regular basis, and it is. I love being able to like recite the Psalms and to order my own prayers around those things, because I could kind of wax poetic about how wonderful the liturgy of the hours is and why it's wonderful to do that. But yeah, you're praying, you know, these Psalms, which help order your own desires and grow your own desires and expand your thoughts. One of the other aspects I love about it is just simply that I know that I'm praying this with other Christians, right. Throughout the world and, really throughout time. Right. That it's a way of showing solidarity and union with other Christians anywhere. So, great. So, in 34, Benedict's point is that, you know, hey, just like hope is not an individualistic thing, prayer is not an individualistic thing either. Like we need to join our prayers. We need an individual prayer life, but we also need to join our prayers to the prayers of the church in some ways. And of course, the main way we're supposed to do that is through the Mass. He doesn't call that out here, but that's I think that's just kind of implicit. 35. So we move on to the next section of action and suffering as settings for learning hope. So in 35, he's talking about acting in hope even in the darkness of this life. He says, "Yet our daily efforts in pursuing our own lives and in working for the world's future either tire us or turn into fanaticism unless we are enlightened by the radiance of the great hope that cannot be destroyed even by small-scale failures or by a breakdown in matters of historic importance. If we cannot hope for more than is effectively attainable at any given time, or more than is promised by political or economic authorities, our lives will soon be without hope. It is important to know that I can always continue to hope, even if in my own life, or the historical period in which I am living, there seems to be nothing left to hope for. Only the great certitude of hope that my own life and history in general, despite all failures, are held firm by the indestructible power of love, and that this gives them their meaning and importance, only this kind of hope can then give the courage to act and to persevere." So, he goes against kind of lowercase h hope, and he says like that's not enough. We need more than that, because if my daily hope is just kind of, you know, can be squashed, and if that happens, then I'm SOL. But if I have the greater hope, then I can persevere through the difficulties of any given day or any given historical period, even, right? And throughout this section, he really cites a lot. He cites, and I think the cardinal was we had heard that from the last section was he had cited earlier in the book and was, he was a prisoner somewhere, and then he cites another Vietnamese prisoner. I think the cardinal was too, but he cites another prisoner. Later in this section, and talks about how they're just in these hellish, horrible conditions, but they still have hope. They still have the Christian hope. And it's the thing they talk about. They give witness to it, helping them persevere even in this dark, even in like the darkest places in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Beautiful stuff. So 36, suffering is a part of our human existence. Great progress has been made in the battle against physical pain, yet the sufferings of the innocent and mental suffering have, if anything, increased in recent decades. Indeed, we must all do all we can to overcome suffering, but to banish it from this world altogether is not in our power. So, suffering, like, because of technology and advancements in medicine, we've been able to overcome a lot of physical suffering in certain cases, but that doesn't mean that even if I think we've started to realize, even if we were able to overcome like all physical suffering or the worst kinds of physical suffering, there's still going to be suffering. Mm-hmm. And because we suffer mentally and we suffer in our souls. And so sometimes that mental suffering can be even worse, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes that mental suffering can be even worse for us.
If you want to get rid of all suffering, you'd have to like have somebody on like an IV of some sort of very strong, you know, numbing medicine, you know.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be human.
Yeah. Make them comfortably numb.
Yeah.
I mean, so he posits that suffering is a part of our human reality, that it's a part of our human existence. So the question becomes, what can we do with those sufferings? We can try to limit suffering, to fight against it, but we cannot eliminate it. It is when we attempt to avoid suffering by withdrawing from anything that might involve hurt, when we try to spare ourselves the effort and pain of pursuing truth, love, and goodness, that we drift into a life of emptiness in which there may be almost no pain, but the dark sensation of meaningless and abandonment is all the greater.
Yeah.
So, and this 37 is where he refers to the Vietnamese martyr, Paul Leo Bao Tin. I think that's how you say it. Apologies to our Vietnamese-speaking listeners if I mispronounced that, but I did my best. We can try to limit this suffering. We can try to fight against it. We can try to eliminate it. But we, you know, ultimately, if that leads to us withdrawing from the fight for truth, love, and goodness, then we land upon a life of emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
How many people today, especially in the first world and in Western societies and wealthier societies, you know, are able to kind of like shield themselves from suffering in various ways, but their lives become empty, right?
Totally.
It's this temptation to just grasp a hold of that and like a comfortable life, but then your life becomes empty if it's not, if you don't use that to pursue a greater, something greater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also maybe to work to alleviate the sufferings of others, right?
Mm-hmm.
That are suffering, then your life can become empty.
Yeah, it gets hollowed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to just have any kind of human relationship that's good, you open yourself up to the possibility of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And once you've been hurt, it's, you know, it's like touching the stovetop as a kid. You do it one time.
Right.
You don't do it again because it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
But with personal relationships, I mean, to have the good, you have to open yourself up to the possibility of being, you know, hurt. It's that's sort of at the emotional and personal level, but I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, well, and he goes on to say that, to talk about how Christ transforms our sufferings.
Mm-hmm.
Christ descended into hell and is therefore close to those cast into it, transforming their darkness into light. Suffering and torment is still terrible and well-nigh unbearable, yet the star of hope has risen. The anchor of the heart reaches the very throne of God. Instead of evil being unleashed within man, the light shines victorious. Suffering, without ceasing to be suffering, becomes, despite everything, a hymn of praise. So through Christ, our sufferings can be transformed. When we offer them up to Christ, our sufferings can be transformed. This is a great mystery. I remember for myself there, after becoming Catholic, there were two times when I, kind of in the first 5 years where I got pretty sick. I think one of them was just like I had a really bad like flu stomach bug. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later I had maybe the same thing happened. There was a time in there I had a gallbladder issue and I was mm-hmm. out of commission for like a week. It was kind of a weird, cuz getting a gallbladder taken out should be like an in and out kind of procedure, but ended up being some complications and I was out of commission for like a week.
Mm.
But I remember the first time after becoming Catholic when I was really kind of really sick, like miserably sick. And I really like, I reflected upon it later and I was like, I really handled this poorly. Like I was like miserable and I was kind of like mad at God and, you know, and I wasn't very prayerful about it. And, you know, it was just kind of like, I mean, I got better, but it was like, I can do better than that. And then the next time, a couple years later, I got sick again. I don't get sick very often, thank
mm-hmm.
God.
Mm-hmm.
But I had kind of a similar situation. And I was better about like kind of being prayerful in the illness and just offering kind of the little, so like, oh God, I feel awful right now, but I offer this up for somebody. And, you know, I was just more prayerful about it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know. It was just, it was a totally different experience. It wasn't like it was any easier to be sick, but it was a much better experience. And I can't put into words exactly why that was, but the experience, like reflecting on the experience of it, I was just in a much better mental and spiritual place during it than I was before.
Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
Huh. Cause you're talking that up to your kind of the deeper sense of like suffering being, can be redeemed. It can be, it can be redeemed and it can help redeem other things. Like you saw it as something that's like forming you.
Right. Yeah. 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 Instead of being like, oh, woe is me, you know, like, you know, kind of selfish in it. Like it was like, well, God's put this into my life right now. So what am I going to do with it? Right. Mm-hmm. Am I going to be, you know, whiny and, you know, woe is me about it? Or am I going to like believe in the power of Christ and offer whatever, you know, the crappiness of what I feel like right now, am I going to offer that for some other good that he can do with it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In union with him. Am I going to offer it in union with his own sufferings, right?
And that acknowledgement or that connection is what hope is about.
Yeah.
That this can be transformed, that you know, it can be a means to a greater good.
Well, and that's what I love about the Christian message is that a large part of it, and I've certainly learned this more becoming Catholic, like your sufferings are not for naught, right? Or they don't have to be, mm-hmm. right? That the thing that's the evil that's been put into your life through the power of Christ can be turned into a weapon for good, for a greater good. Like that to me is one of the core mysteries that Christ inaugurates, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, throughout the time before Christ, like human reality is just an increasing suffering, and you know, it's just like everything seems to be going downhill. But through Christ and through his passion, through the Paschal mystery, he flips everything on its head.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't necessarily remove our sufferings. And for the Christian, you may even have more sufferings. You probably should have more sufferings, right? But through that, like you're able to, we become more than conquerors. Like it's the whole St. Paul idea. Through Christ, we become more than conquerors,
mm-hmm.
right? Not even death, illness, any of those things can separate us from the love of God. And it's through Christ's power that, because we're tapping in ultimately to the thing that led to his resurrection, right? Through his passion, we're tapping into, you know, when we unite ourselves to his passion and whatever sufferings we have, we're tapping into the same power that led to his resurrection, the shattering of the gates of Sheol, of death and Hades, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All of those things, right?
Right. To be united to his life, you have to be united with him in death.
Exactly.
That's the sort of meaning of baptism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we also, we, you know, we need to share in others. He talks about, we're on 38. He talks about what compassion is, consolation, you know, really is a master's in English guy. I love when we go into like the roots of words and that kind of thing, and really what the ideas are we're talking about. Consolation is one that's meant a lot to me since becoming Catholic, just this idea of, you know, the consoling power of beauty, of love, of truth, of goodness. He says it suggests being with the other in his solitude so that it ceases to be solitude. And in that, again, I kind of get this mystical notion that like in our sufferings, we can reach across space and time to one another and console one. And I think about like you and me in our kind of in a relatively comfortable existence, in, you know, in the United States in 2019, versus Christians who suffer in very anti-Christian countries,
mm-hmm.
In the same time, and you know, maybe who are suffering very actively right now, and are being able to offer our prayers for them, and you know, we have no idea who these people are. We have no idea what they look like, what their names are, but we know they exist. And the notion that, like, in the light of heaven, we'll see how it all worked, right? We'll see how our prayers maybe helped a person persevere. Or maybe on the flip side of it, how their prayers helped us, and
right,
because their sufferings were so much greater, right?
Yeah,
you know, where you know how they and that they receive the crown of life through those things, right?
Yeah,
a greater share, a greater treasure in heaven through those sufferings.
Yep.
39. The capacity to suffer for truth is the measure of humanity. He says, in the history of humanity, it was the Christian faith that had the particular merit of bringing forth within man a new and deeper capacity for these kinds of suffering that are decisive for his humanity. The Christian faith has shown us that truth, justice, and love are not simply ideals, but enormously weighty realities. It has shown us that God, truth and love in person, desired to suffer for us and with us. Bernard of Clairvaux coined the marvelous expression, impassilibus est Deus, sed non incompassionibilis. Yeah. Not a Latin scholar, people. Yeah. God cannot suffer, but he can suffer with.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the idea of that God is impassible, that God doesn't change, God is perfect, that you know, there's no shadow of change in God. He's infinitely good. There's no
right,
no lack. But, you know, that idea of God doesn't freeze God in some like static existence, like over and beyond, where he doesn't concern himself with the suffering of others, the suffering of his creatures. He suffers with, as you know, in the revelation of Jesus Christ's life and teaching and death and resurrection shows us.
Yeah.
That God joins himself with, not freely, with us in our suffering.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, one of those mysteries, and we, you know, we can kind of get in, you know, you can get into like incarnational theology here, you know, talking about the hypostatic union, the divine and the human natures. Well, you know, is it right to say coexisting in the person of Christ, in the, you know, in the historical person of Christ? And yeah, you can get on some serious rabbit trails with that and exactly how that all that works. But but the point here is that, yeah, God does not change. God is not, he is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, forever, right? But Christ, in taking on the human nature, still experiences the life of the human. He still has emotions because of his human nature. And he still experiences pain because of his human nature, but that's somehow united. It doesn't get away from the fact that his divine nature is still there and is all those things we just said about it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great phrase from the early fathers, from the Greek fathers.
Totally.
They say God suffers unsufferingly. It's sort of a paradox. And the point is that when we reach these sort of these deep things in Christianity, the paradox sort of starts to unravel our ability to comprehend it, and we have to like affirm both at the same time. God suffers, but in a divine way, in an unsuffering way. And he's like, you have to affirm both.
Yeah.
And so sort of wonderful.
Yeah. And once you do, you can really enter in, once you have affirmed those things, you can really enter into the mystery of it, right? Like once you kind of surrender to, like, you know, it's hard for me to grasp how this works. It's not contradictory. It's a paradox, which are two different things. And it allows me to enter into the deeper mystery of the incarnation and of the Trinitarian life.
Yeah. It would be a contradiction to say that I suffer unsufferingly.
Right.
Like at the level of our domain, creaturely domain, those two things are contradictory. But when you put God in the mix, infinite reality, the source and ground of all things, that's sort of in excess of, you know, the distinctions by which I comprehend things in this world. Like he's infinitely great and far away, but also closer to me than I am to myself. You know, it's yes and yes. So anyway,
yes,
it's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. Well,
and wonderful.
I've been thinking, you know, come back to the words of my God, why have you forsaken me? Like, I guess I've been thinking about those words a lot lately and what exactly they mean. The other couple of days ago, I was thinking, like, I was kind of thinking about Christ uttering those words on the cross. And what are, like, what does that entail? What was he going through in that moment? And one of the things that dawned on me that maybe he was going through was he was experiencing in that moment all of the sufferings of the human race. Like each person who's ever died, you know, a painful, undignified, lonely death, right? That he was experiencing, right, in solidarity with each and every person, you know, mm-hmm. all the billions of people that have lived.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And all of the loneliness, the darkness, the pain, the agony, emotional, physical, spiritual, all these things, that because he is the head, right, of, you know, he is the head of the mystical body, that he was experiencing all of this,
yeah,
in that moment, right? Yeah. That he was there and consoling us in solidarity with us in all of those dark moments. And that cry is like, that's an expression of that, right? Like, because each of us has those moments when we feel like, why have you forsaken me? Right? Why have you left me utterly alone here?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So yeah, that's cool. It's like the representative human cry.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you, God?
Right.
Right. Your world devolves into chaos in many places, a lot.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on here? Where are you?
Mm-hmm. And that's awesome, because that tells us that, you know, when we ponder, like, all the people who've, like, I sometimes just think about all the people who, like, you know, we have all the stories of, like, the, you know, in World War II, like, the Western Front. We kind of look at World War II through a very U.S., you know, centric lens here in the United States, obviously. And, but you think about, like, all of the, like, Russian people and all the people in, like, the countries of the E that are east of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, you know, it was bad with what the United States had to go through, but it was so much worse in that area. And just people whose names we'll never know, you know, because they were already living under a horrible regime, and then they have to, like, fight against, you know, mm-hmm. against an, you know, equally, or if not even more horrible regime. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, people just kind of with no weapons, just kind of being thrown into the front lines, being like, here, absorb some bullets for us. Right.
Man.
I mean, just like, you know, and it's like, it's just absurd, like, mm-hmm. to think about that.
Yeah.
But you realize that Christ, he knows each and every one of those names, and he, because of his incarnation, was experiencing in himself each, like, and he was in that person, like, with that person,
yep.
right? In that, right? Yeah. I don't know, just something that dawned on me in all this, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then so moving on, getting back to the text here, 40, Benedict says, offer it up. What does that mean? So this is a phrase we hear a lot in Catholic circles. It sometimes, I guess, has been, you know, maybe used in a, I hear cradle Catholics say, like, oh yeah, my mom used to always tell me to offer it up, and it was kind of like a snarky thing to say when I was complaining. But Benedict argues that no, there's actually something really great about this, right? Then in our little daily annoyances, whatever, that if we instead of complaining and becoming bitter, and, you know, in these small ways, what if we offered them up in union with Christ? Because is any suffering that we experience too small for that? Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Any suffering that we experience is not good enough for God's new creation.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's not the Creator's plan. It's all sort of off the mark. And therefore, in the Christian, you know, in way of being and seeing, those things can be transformed. They can transform us, like your suffering did, you know, when you were sick. Even these little things can expand us. They can help us see a greater horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even more to that. That idea of offering them up, that they we can join them to Christ's sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
like the sacrifice that's offered to God, and you know, somehow strangely does something in the world.
Yeah. Well, the metaphor that pops into my head is the analogy of everything a mother goes through in order to bring a child into the world, right? Mm-hmm. That 9 month period of, you know, there's of course the birth pains at the moment of delivery, but there's also all these little things that that mothers have to put up with during that period, and you know, it can be kind of a miserable thing, or you know, but I think a lot of times mothers will realize like, well, this is all for the sake of my child, right? Like this is all for them. And so therefore, when I keep it in that perspective, it becomes a beautiful thing. Maybe not an easier to go through. Maybe, you know, you have to laugh about it and, you know, and those sorts of things and keep a good sense of humor about it. But when you think about it in light of the new child and the joy of the new life, right? The beauty and the joy of the new life,
yeah,
that will result. Even the little daily things, right? You know, just feeling uncomfortable, right? In certain ways. Like all of that, you know, when you see all those little things in the light of the new life, they become worthwhile. And you're almost like, I've never been pregnant, so I don't want to speak for a pregnant mother, but it's like, I can imagine being like, wow, it was worth it. And in ways I wish I could go back and like have better perspective in some of those moments too, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, man, you could challenge yourself to think about this, but is there anything kind of the higher goods, you know, like friendship or justice in the world or, you know, all the way up to union with God, which is the highest good. Mm-hmm. Are any of those things all of those things you have to suffer for, you have to work for,
yeah,
you have to discipline yourself, you have to put aside smaller goods to realize those, the higher goods.
Yep.
It's like, you know, it's a pattern or something. There's something there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's knock out this last section here. All right. So we talked about prayer as a school of hope. We've talked about action and suffering as a school of hope. And then now we're going to talk about judgment as a school of hope, which is probably the most startling one to hear as a school of hope for most people.
Yeah. No one wants to talk about that.
Yeah. But actually for, judgment properly understood in terms of the Christian hope is a hopeful thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very hopeful thing. From the earliest times, the prospect of the judgment has influenced Christians in their daily living as a criterion by which to order their present life, as a summons to their conscience, and at the same time as hope in God's justice. As the iconography of the Last Judgment developed, more and more prominence was given to its ominous and frightening aspects, which obviously held more fascination for artists than the splendor of hope, often all too well concealed beneath the horrors. So, hope, like justice, God's justice, has always been a source of hope for Christians, especially from the earliest times. But maybe over time, there became a greater emphasis on, you know, on the horrors and the frightening aspects, the hellfire and brimstone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Became maybe overemphasized in a lot of these depictions. And Benedict, I think, wants to recover the idea of judgment in the here and now, but also the last judgment as a good thing, as something to be hopeful for. So he says, the fundamental content of awaiting a final judgment, however, has not disappeared. It has simply taken on a totally different form. The atheism of the 19th and 20th centuries and its origin and aims, a type of moralism, a protest against the injustices of the world and of world history. Since there is no God to create justice, it seems man himself is now called to establish justice. So he gets back again to what we talked about in previous sections where, you know, there's a false hope that has kind of replaced the Christian hope in the modern age,
mm-hmm.
You know, because so many people either explicitly don't believe in God or effectively don't believe in God, don't live as though they believe in God. We place more hope in our own abilities and even in a type of moralism and like, well, we just need to create... you know, we need to work to create true justice and these kind of things. And as much truth as there may be in that, that's never going to accomplish the hope that people want.
And doesn't it always, often, maybe always, a lot of the time you can see in history that creates injustice for others.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to create your vision of justice, it's just too small.
Right.
It's way too small. And it, you know, it ruins and destroys other people.
Yeah. And a lot of times it's about, you know, the it's about this like human anger, right, against the injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, like the we should feel anger towards true injustice,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But one of the passages I always come back to, and it's one I actually read. I think it's in the 4 week Psalter, speaking of the Liturgy of the Hours. One of the short readings from James is to paraphrase. It basically says, "Man's anger does not accomplish the justice of God." Right?
Mm-hmm.
Man's anger does not accomplish the justice of God.
Yeah.
And again, he's trying to get people to kind of harness their emotions, harness their feelings of injustice. He's not saying don't do anything about it. He's saying your anger is not the way to accomplish that, right? You know, just kind of unleashing your anger upon an injustice is not the way to accomplish God's justice. Because too often for us, the anger becomes about retribution. It becomes about revenge, about getting back at someone for the wrong that they did.
Mm-hmm.
But God's justice is always, it's always about reparation. It's always about repairing,
mm-hmm.
About putting something to right. So, let's see. So since there is no God, he says a world which has to create its own justice is a world without hope. No one and nothing can answer for centuries of suffering. No one and nothing can guarantee that the cynicism of power, whatever beguiling ideological mask it adopts, will cease to dominate this world. This is a thought that's often crossed my mind when I think about like the social justice movement and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
With as many positives as there are associated with it, there's this sense in which like the efforts human like kind of the human efforts of social justice detached from God always have to live with this ghost over them, which is that every battle that was lost is lost. Like every human that's died in injustice, like there will never be any justice for them. All we can do is kind of try in the right now for justice and do some little part of it. So ultimately at the end of the day, past injustice wins out, right?
Mm-hmm.
It already won, right?
Yeah.
In that view.
Right.
And that would, you know, I mean, if you stop to think about that, that would be completely disheartening. But it could also lead you to want to cry out for a greater justice and be like, God, is it possible that there is a God who could put past injustices to right?
Yeah.
To borrow the words of the great prophet Samwise Gamgee, is it possible that everything sad could come untrue?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And as he quotes this German philosopher Horkheimer, the answer to that is resurrection. Even if Horkheimer didn't believe in the resurrection,
mm-hmm.
Seemingly, yeah. But he realized that the past injustices have to be undone, and for the present to be just, for the mm-hmm. world to be just, and that the idea of resurrection fulfills that obligation.
Yeah,
that it's a just world requires resurrection. If we're going to believe in justice and its possibility, then you have to hope in the resurrection.
Yeah.
If your idea of justice has to be that big, resurrection, all past wrongs made right.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah. Well, and that's what we actually see at the end of Revelation. If we take Revelation to be the book of Revelation to be, you know, kind of the picture of a picture of the final judgment in parts of it. At the very end of the book, what do we see? We see every tear
mm-hmm.
being wiped away,
yep.
right?
Yep.
Every tear being wiped away. If each one of those tears is a representation of some past injustice, it's being wiped away. It's as if it never happened, right? Or as if the good that came out of it was so much, the good that God created out of it.
Yeah.
Was so much greater than the injustice itself that it's just like
yeah.
a strange memory.
That's right. It's like the, you know, this probably commented on a lot and rightfully so, but you know, the resurrected Christ still has his wounds
mm-hmm.
that those aren't like erased, but they're glorified
mm-hmm.
and that his unjust suffering is transformed by the resurrection.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the goal for all creation.
Yes.
In all history. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Moving on to 43. Did I skip one? No, I didn't. All right. Let's see. I'm going to skip over that. I didn't get a whole lot out of the thing about images here, but let's skip on to 44. Only God can create justice, and faith gives us the certainty that he does so. He says, is the picture of the last judgment not also a frightening image? I would say it is an image that evokes responsibility, an image, therefore, of that fear of which St. Hilary spoke when he said that all our fear has its place in love. God is justice and creates justice. Grace does not cancel out justice. It does not make wrong into right. It is not a sponge which wipes everything away so that whatever someone has done on earth ends up being of equal value. Dostoevsky, for example, was right to protest against this kind of heaven and this kind of grace in his novel, The Brothers Karamazov. Evildoers in the end do not sit at table at the eternal banquet besides their victims without distinction, as though nothing had happened. So there's not this, like, you know, heaven is not this uncomfortable place of, like, oh, we'll just pretend like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
But there's also a sense in which it's not like, you know, the people who have been tortured before, you know, or, you know, suffered before at the hands of others are not, like, up there, like, whipping the ones who suffered them,
mm-hmm.
you know, who made them suffer either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because as any person, I think, you know, you especially hear about this with, like, I feel like I hear about this with, like, victims of rape and that kind of thing. Like, you know, there's oftentimes when they bring that something like that has happened to them, when they bring that to another person, especially, you know, if a woman brings that to a man that's a friend or, you know, father or brother or something like that, like, the response of the friend is often to want to go and, like, just knock the crap out of the person who did
it. Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Understandably. And a lot of times, you know, they say, like, no, like, actually the victim doesn't really want that, right? The victim, you know, that the victim doesn't want more violence, right? And I think that holds true in a lot of, you know, in a lot of violent crimes. Like, you know, there's this sense in which a retributive violence doesn't make anything better,
mm-hmm.
right? It just seems to multiply the problem. Yeah, like, there's also a mysterious kind of way in which I guess all I'm trying to say is we see here that God's way of justice is not necessarily our way of justice, that what mm-hmm. we think of as justice, and that, you know, our anger does not accomplish the righteousness of God, the justice of God.
Yeah.
Let's see. We must note, so he talks about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And he said, we must note that in this parable, Jesus is not referring to the final destiny after the last judgment, but is taking up a notion found inter alia in early Judaism, namely that of an intermediate state between death and resurrection, a state in which the final sentence is yet to be pronounced. Yeah, you know, I wish Benedict had a little more time to expand on some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of really interesting things that Jesus talks about in the Bible that don't necessarily mean what we think they mean.
Yeah.
And this is one of those parables where, you know, I think it's become increasingly clear to people that, you know, Jesus is not talking about this rich man being in hell as we commonly think about it. He's talking about him being in this, like, you know, what's called Abraham's bosom, I think. And, you know, in kind of this holding place in pre-Christ for the dead. We might think of it as like Hades or Sheol, right?
Yeah.
It's this abode of the dead. And it would have been cool to hear. Because Benedict's such a brilliant guy, we've been here, cool to hear about him expound on this a little more. But in 46, he goes into, basically the last section, the last few articles here, he gets into talking about purgatory and the role that purgatory plays in this concept of justice.
Yeah. Well, I think that idea of an intermediate state sort of opens the doorway to talking about, like, a state of purgation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, with death, our life choice becomes definitive. Our life stands before the judge. Our choice, which is the course of an entire life, takes on a certain shape, can have a variety of forms. There can be people who have totally destroyed their desire for truth and readiness to love, people for whom everything has become a lie, people who have lived for hatred and have suppressed all love within themselves. This is a terrifying thought, but alarming profiles of this type can be seen in certain figures of our own history. And he says, in such people, all would be beyond remedy, and the destruction of good would be irrevocable. That is what we mean by the word hell. On the other hand, there can be people who are utterly pure, completely permeated by God, and thus fully open to their neighbors, people for whom communion with God even now gives direction to their entire being, and whose journey towards God only brings to fulfillment what they already are. So, so purgatory kind of sets off for us the idea that, like, when we die, most of us are not everything we should be, right? Everything we were created to be. In other words, we're not perfect. So purgatory becomes the place where, through the power of Christ, we can realize that hope, right? Yeah. Of becoming truly holy as we were, and truly perfect as we were created to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sort of sets out those two opposite poles of the person whom, has sort of completely suppressed, the light of goodness in themselves and just become like total monster, like subhuman type. Kind of thing. I mean, I don't think he says that's a reality, but it's a possibility held out to us, and our actions mean something. And when you do, you do something wrong, it becomes easier to do it. It's a vice. Mm-hmm. It becomes more and more and more and more. You become more and more like what you do. We make ourselves what we are.
Right.
We're the authors of who we are. I mean, the things happen to us, and our responsibility may or may not be, diminished in those circumstances, mm-hmm. but we are free, to respond to what happens to us and make our decisions. And you have those two poles, the one who, sort of suppresses all goodness in themselves as much as they can and like rebels against God. And then the other, like the person of, purity and sanctity, like the saint who does the opposite.
Yep.
So then the next paragraph, he's going to be like, well, most of us are somewhere in between.
Yeah.
We're all a mix.
Right.
So.
He refers, of course, to St. Paul's letter where he talks about, God's the fire of God being this purifying fire that burns away the dross. If anyone builds on the foundations with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work which any man has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So, that's kind of this image of, that the church has come to call purgatory over time. This final purifying fire that we pass through in order to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
The judgment of God is hope, but both because it is justice and because it is grace. If it were merely grace making all earthly things cease to matter, God would still owe us an answer to the question about justice, the crucial question that we ask of history and of God. If it were merely justice, in the end it would bring only fear to us all. The incarnation of God in Christ has so closely linked the two together, justice and grace, that justice is firmly established. We all work out our salvation with fear and trembling. Nevertheless, grace allows us all to hope and to go trustfully to meet the judge whom we know as our advocate, or Parakletos. I understand what he's saying here with justice and grace shouldn't be opposed to each other, but I almost feel like grace encompasses justice amongst other things, right? That true justice, because it's a good, is if grace is like the life of God, is the life of God coming to us, right? Then justice resides within grace, right? That justice isn't true justice unless it's truly graceful, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a way. So I don't know, just a little thought that occurred to me.
Hmm.
Because oftentimes you see mercy and justice like being being opposed to one another, but in my mind, like grace is encompasses all of that, right? That it's all God's God's will to put the world to rights, to create the world into the fully complete thing that he desires it to be.
Yeah. I think then in that sense, justice is an expression of God's love because God loves his world.
Right.
And injustice has no place there. It has to be put right. But it would be easy to sort of circumscribe these ideas by our own conceptions, but I feel like in my mind, those two things, like justice and mercy or God's love and God's justice, it's one of those paradox things where like, I have to hold them both together. I just don't know how they're held together,
mm-hmm.
And, but we can say one, justice It is God is an expression of God's love, and love's an expression of His justice. There's these two in God. Those different facets of things that we have to hold apart. They're all one, and I think that's what you're pointing to.
Yes, absolutely. So the last number 48 here is about assisting those who are in purgatory, and basically Benedict just reiterates that we can assist those in purgatory by our prayers. We can offer prayers, we can offer the Eucharist, and we can offer almsgiving for them. So, and that provides them with solace and refreshment within the fires of purgatory, the purifying fires of purgatory. Got a little frog in my throat. All right. So, we end everything here with a short reflection on Mary, the Star of Hope. And so I will just say, like, this is a beautiful little section. You should go read it. And you should also listen to, find a good chant of Ave Maria Stella, because it's a beautiful Latin hymn there. If you can find the old school version of it. I think there's probably multiple ones, but I have one in my head, certainly from, from the first millennium that comes down to us today. But Mary is the star of the sea. Mary is the, here we are adrift on, kind of the sea of this world, maybe in darkness, not knowing the right direction to go. And Mary is held up to us as a star on which to fix ourselves on this journey. She reflects the light, the true light of Jesus Christ, right? So in the darkness of the night, if Christ is the sun, right, she is the moon reflecting the light to us, that she is the star, the distant star in the midst of the darkness that can bring His light to us.
Yeah. So yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Well, we did it. Woo! It only took us like a million episodes.
Man, we need some mimosas in here. That'd be cool. We did it.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And we will, we got to talk about what we're going to be doing next. We got some ideas, but we haven't quite figured it all out yet. But you got to get on to work. So,
yeah, man. Working man. Working man.
Cut you loose.
All right.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk at you next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.